You're listening to a Stranger podcast, www.thestranger.com.
Hello, and thank you again for downloading another Dear Science podcast. I'm Jonathan Golub, the senior science stringer at The Stranger, and with me today is Erica Barnett, the senior news writer here at The Stranger.
We're all senior.
We're all senior. It's kind of like The Daily Show in its own creepy way. And we're going to talk today a little bit about a big vote that went down in Seattle a couple weeks ago at the beginning of November, voting for a package of roads and transit together, which is sort of a weird frankincense sort of thing. So, Erica, would you like to describe it?
Yeah. So it was called the Roads and Transit Package. It was $18 billion total. About $10 billion of that was for 50 new miles of light rail. And the rest was for highway expansion and some HOV lanes. And the reason they were wedded together was because the roads package had been in the works for 5 years on its own. And it was polling terribly. It was totally unsuccessful. The legislature could never get anything together that people would actually pass. So light rail is incredibly popular, particularly in the Seattle area. And so they linked them together so that if one... For either one to pass, both had to pass. So, thus we kind of ended up with this like Frankenstein monster of roads and transit together. So, as in most places, the politics of that is pretty ugly. The roads people hate the transit people hate the roads people, and all of a sudden they were in this shotgun wedding.
Yeah, if I recall correctly, there was already a vote in the past just for a roads only package, and it went down to dismal failure.
Yeah,
and
this failed like 58-42%.
And just in case people aren't from Seattle listening to this, we're just now having our first mass transit rail line completing in about 2 years. It's been forever. I mean, they've been fighting over this. We actually had a separate one on the monorail line that was killed in a vote after. Is it five votes?
Five votes.
So if you're getting a sense, Seattle is the place where things get voted on over and over again. And so this is kind of, it's a weird jiving, right? So the Seattle's supposed to be a leader in green, and the mayor likes going out and giving lots of talks, but we're still in a fairly large city with no real mass transit system, aside from buses, which we will argue the merits of them. I have data with me today about this, because in Seattle, this is one of those things where the roads people always are saying, oh, well, we have buses, and buses are great, and they're cheap, and you have enough buses, and you should live with it.
And that's the politics of buses everywhere. The people who support them are the people who don't ride them.
Yeah, of course. I mean, and I've ridden buses on many, many cities, and I think you have as well, and it really comes down to a fundamental problem with the bus, which is the buses are almost always about the same speed or slower than the cars. Just because they're stuck in traffic, you end up being clumped together. And the key thing with getting people out of their cars and using transit, a good transit system, is that it's faster and more convenient than driving, and particularly at peak times of day. And I think anyone who's lived in a city with a mass transit system kind of knows it. And I think maybe part of the problem is here, a lot of people have moved up from Southern California where there's, you know.
Maybe. I mean, I don't know. I think the problem is we have this culture here where it's very, very difficult to change anything, and people are very averse to change. People are still lamenting the fact that in 1968 we rejected light rail, and it took between 1968 and 1996 to actually vote on a plan. So there was a lot of trepidation around this roads and transit plan that if we didn't pass it, we're never going to get anything.
Yeah, I mean, definitely there was a lot of wrenching. And I think, you know, it's sort of one of those fun things. I think in a couple years now when this first light rail line gets completed, which is basically a subway through Seattle. I mean, there's a few stretches where it's at grade, but for the most part, it's dug deep underground. I think it will kind of change people's minds. It'll be like the best advertisement in and of itself.
I think so too, even
its limits. So just to prove that we're not pontificating, I brought my sister's civil engineering class traffic engineering textbook.
Wow, how old is that
thing? It's only a couple years old, actually. My sister's a little bit younger than I am. She's a licensed civil engineer, not in the Seattle area. So, and I have her textbook. And what we have here, I'm going to read off. I brought a prop to a podcast, so I'm going to have to read it to you. But we have a table here. It's a study done in Northern Virginia comparing bus versus rail service. And there are all these different criteria. And rail won out on availability, absolute travel time, reliability, comfort, convenience, safety and security, frequency and operating costs, capacity, passenger attraction, and system impact. So in all of these factors, every single one of them in an empiric test, rail was better than bus. Bus won out on exactly two: original cost, capital cost, and area of coverage. And it's
But those two things are very important. I mean, you can't cover a whole city with rail, right? It's just impossible. And I just wrote a story where I did a little research, and this didn't make it into the story, I don't think. But in L.A., 90% of the cost of their transit system was commuter rail to the suburbs. 10% was buses. And the buses were slow. And this made the bus riders furious, and they sued. And they won because, I mean, there is like an inequity issue there where these capital costs, you end up paying for them for 50 years. So it's not like it's just an initial cost.
For sure. And I think that speaks well that the best systems have a proper blend. I mean, even in New York, you hop on a bus for some things, and it's the best way to do it. But I think what this table doesn't include is a whole other separate thing. I think this is where we get into some trouble in our debates, which is that transit systems are as much about development and land use patterns as they are about getting people from point A to point B. And in some ways, rail has a lot of superior characteristics if we're thinking about how to make a city that's sustainable and combat sprawl and encourage density and all of these things. And I think we can kind of see that. I mean, there's already some prospective development along the light rail route in Seattle that would never, I think, come with a bus line.
Sure. I mean, you don't, but that's the problem with buses. You don't get good development around the stations unless you build the stations. I mean, there's an argument for bus rapid transit, which is, you know, sort of the compromise between just a bus system and rail. And it's much, much cheaper than rail. And there's an argument that says, if you build the stations as if they were rail stations, and if you create some permanency around the bus, like depots, you can actually get development there. Now, I don't know how that's played out. I don't know that that's played out all that well in practice because, you know, what ends up happening is the buses, you know, start out with dedicated right-of-ways at first, and then the cars get a little bit, and they get a little bit more, and then you have buses stuck in traffic. And that's definitely, I mean, like you said, that's the downside of buses.
And that's sort of the fun thing. I mean, the negative and positive of rail is that it's very permanent. It's expensive to build, and once you build it, it's not very, you can't move it very easily. And that's why it's such a good driver of development, is once it's there, and people can feel comfortable building around it because it's going to be there for 50 years.
But the downside of that in this debate, just real quickly, is that, you know, in Tacoma, the rail line that they were talking about building was going out to a relatively sort of undeveloped area. And so then, you know, you're kind of spurring sprawl. And is that, you know, is it a good thing that you're at least spurring sprawl that's, you know, that's served by rail? Or would it be better to go somewhere that's, you know, sort of marginally developed and build that up, which is what's happening in the rest of Seattle. Tacoma's south of Seattle. That was the part of the line that was really controversial.
Yeah, it was this long extension sort of through semi-rural areas, right, for the most part. And I think, you know, this kind of gets to an interesting point, because I think cities with good rail, commuter rail systems, it actually ends up boosting up the burbs. And it makes the kind of suburbs, I think, that people, when they think of suburbs, they actually think of. Like, I don't think anyone conjures up the image of, like, Federal Way or when they think of, like, the glorious suburban life. But I'm thinking of, like, the cities along the metro lines in Chicago, like Naperville. It gets rated as one of the nicest places to live. And that city would never exist if it wasn't for that light rail system. It wouldn't exist the way it is. This little town where you can get to downtown Chicago in 45 minutes super reliably. And this is sort of the point, actually, that I think this is one of the odd things in the debate, because everyone sort of views rail as being very pro big city urban area. And I think actually rail might have the biggest impact in sort of like the exurbs and suburban towns, where a lot of people will kind of have in their image where they want to raise their kids. And so it's this weird voting pattern where people in Seattle really have been consistently very pro rail, and people sort of out in the burbs haven't been. Although it's starting to change, right? Some of the east side, some of the suburban cities of Seattle, the bigger ones like Bellevue and Redmond,
for sure. Which is, I mean, that's a little bit different, you know. And actually, I mean, it's interesting because the main opponent of this is a developer in Bellevue who would actually get Kemper Freeman, who would actually have gotten a rail station in his own development. I mean, essentially at his front door. And he opposed it, but I would imagine that the people who he's sort of wanting to bring there to live in these condos in downtown Bellevue would love it. And same thing with Redmond. I mean, Redmond is where Microsoft is, and, you know, Microsoft employees largely live in Seattle and, you know, in other suburbs of Seattle, and they would love rail. You know, I mean, I think that they certainly voted for. And in fact, I mean, the transit part of this package passed everywhere. according to exit polls. I mean, everybody, if it had been separate, it would have passed.
So this is sort of the fun thing. I mean, I laugh at this because, you know, the Seattleites vote for this package predominantly. Suburbanites don't. And the net result is that Microsoft's planning now on opening a gigantic campus in Seattle for their expansion. That's the rumor, at least, down in Lake Union.
It's I hadn't heard that. That's
yeah, yeah. And so, like, you know, and Amazon's continuing to expand on there, and Google's talking. So it's sort of this weird thing. The more difficult you make it to commute, the more I think the central city actually does better. Like, you actually give a little advantage because you make commuting such a miserable activity. And so it's sort of fun. I mean, so the other counter arguments, so you had two sides of counter arguments to this that I thought was kind of interesting, again, in a big debate. You have the anti-transit people, like, it's expensive, we don't need it, it's a toy. And then you have the anti-roads part of it, which is like more like Sierra Club arguing against for climate change. And so maybe you can, because you were following this argument pretty well, Erica.
Yeah, so I actually brought some notes because I don't have these numbers memorized by heart. But so the Sierra Club made the argument. So there was a big divide in the environmental community here about whether this would be good or bad for global warming and whether it would have a negative impact. And the sort of more, I guess, moderate side of the environmental community said it'll be good because we're going to at least have rail, and it's better to have more lane miles for cars to be in then have fewer because you'll have less idling and, you know, and thus fewer emissions. Mm-hmm. And the Sierra Club and this organization called the Sightline Institute came out with an analysis that said that, in fact, for every lane mile of road you add, you get 100,000 more tons of greenhouse gases. And this is a rough analysis, mm-hmm. obviously. The other argument that they certainly conceded that, you know, if you build new lane miles of road, you get less congestion in the very short term. The problem is that lane miles of road fill up, and then, you know, within 10 years, I mean, because you have this thing called induced demand.
Exactly, because land development matches what you built.
And people take unnecessary trips that they would have maybe combined or that they would have taken at a different time of day. If it's easy and convenient to go, you know, on the freeway at 5 p.m, you're going to do that.
For sure. And actually, that's one of the fun things that, I'm not going to read this whole textbook, because one of the other fun things is, like, what determines how many trips you take. It's not just commuting. This is the fun thing. The more disposable income you have, the more trips you take, because you're going to, like, the grocery store and the bank and all this other crap. And it's these short trips that end up killing the both the environment and the roads. It's like these... And so... The key to this, making a city that does it, is to support development where all these things like the bank and the grocery store and the movie theater and everything is kind of within short distance of your house. And that totally comes up, though. Like, so you add in the roads. And then, you know, this whole other thing, you know, it's sort of weird how all of this had come together, because at the same time, then you have the University of Washington report on what climate change is expected to do here. Now, I believe there's a lot of general press, a lot of discussion is that how can we stop global warming? You have Al Gore, you have all of this stuff going on. How are we going to stop global warming from happening? And I'm here to tell you, global warming is going to happen. I think there's no way politically that anything is going to get organized to actually stop it. If you look at the raw data, the current amounts of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere there's about a 1 in 5 chance that they're already too high.
Well, I think you're being a little unfair to Al Gore. Yeah. I don't think he's saying that we need to stop global warming. I think he's saying we need to reverse catastrophic climate change before it becomes truly catastrophic. I mean, nobody, I don't think any credible scientist is saying right now that we can just stop it in its tracks and make it not happen. I mean, they're saying let's not have like a 3-meter sea level rise if we can prevent that.
If we can prevent it, I mean, but that's an interesting. The data behind that says that there's all the computer models, and some of the better ones say, you know, already current levels. And then you look at like what's going on politically, what's being done to try to reduce carbon emissions, and you're talking about things like the Kyoto Accord is maybe your most successful, your gold standard, even though United States and many other places haven't signed on to it, and even that is just a reduction in the rate of increase.
Well, but you know, I think it's the Bali Accord that that Gore is working on right now would actually be incredibly ambitious, and I don't know if it's achievable because it would require 90% reductions by the U.S. Which, I mean, even like just getting back to the micro level of this transportation package that we just rejected. So if we had passed it, the estimates were that greenhouse gas emissions would go up around 40%. If we do nothing, if we don't pass any more light rail, if we just build the light rail we have on the ground, do absolutely nothing, greenhouse gas emissions... well, actually, I'm sorry. if we build additional light rail, build no more roads, greenhouse gas emissions go down anywhere from 2 to 5%.
And this is sort of like the joke, right? You like you have one side of it, the climate scientists saying like we need to reduce emissions by like 90% to kind of halt things, and then you have on the other side of it the actual policy, and we're debating fairly viciously about 5-10% reductions,
right?
And so this is where in my mind, you know, this is where I get pessimistic and start having to drink heavily after researching your many questions on how to do climate change. Like this is where like things like, you know, compact fluorescent light bulbs versus incandescents. I mean, all of these things help, but
it sort of cracks me up. I mean, the other day the mayor had a big rolling out of this like bright idea plan, which was it turns out his bright idea was to give away CFLs to 40,000 low-income housing residents. And you know, the press release was like, said, you know, if every light bulb in Seattle was switched to a CFL, you know, we'd reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, you know, whatever,
and then
by 50 gazillion whatever. But you know, but you're talking about, you know, giving away 40,000 light bulbs. It doesn't really have very much of an impact.
No, and then they're all filled with mercury. So you have to, like, if you think about it holistically, like, around, you know, the actual environmental impact of this overall, in a city where 90% of our power or so already comes from non-carbon-producing sources. This is sort of the silliness behind a lot of this thinking and a lot of this fun. I mean, and then you do have the turnaround, though, that Seattle and some ways is really well off for climate change, and other ways is actually has a couple things where we're going to be hurting pretty bad. Again, I'm just going to say, assuming that the trends continue and that the carbon levels continue to increase, and we're looking at maybe like a 5 to 10 degree increase in temperatures year round in mid part of the century. Seattle is going to hurt a lot because of the reduction in snowpack. We get all of our power, most of our power from hydropower, most of our water from this melted snow in the mountains. And any skier can tell you a couple degrees difference in the winter makes a big difference in how much snow. It's bad for the salmon. It's bad for drinking water as well. But on the alternate, we live next to one of the deepest lakes in the world, you know, like, so in some ways we're way better off than Georgia, you know, so that's hay for positivity,
right,
here.
Right. Well, they're praying for, actually, I guess their prayers were answered, right?
I don't know if their prayers were answered. I think they need like a hurricane or two to really have their prayers answered. So prayer, this is Now in Your Science podcast. We've come to the point now where the only hope for the South in climate change is prayer. And so start praying now. I recommend a split thing. How many gods should we go for here? I think 4 would be a reasonable...
Sure. One for the South, one for... You know,
one for the Pacific Islanders.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
You know, I feel a little
we'll
bit.
We'll pray to Mammon.
Yeah, we're gonna go and say this, that, you know, the nice thing is Seattle is close to Canada, where we're gonna do reasonably well in climate change, which is scary given that we're gonna hurt pretty badly, and the projections are we're gonna do pretty well. And University of Washington just released a big report on this. And so we're going to continue debating light rail, which is sort of funny because that's the thing that should be said here with all this talk about light bulbs and everything else. The overwhelming largest contributor to global warming gases is transportation
in this region. Yeah,
in this region, and I think in many regions around particularly
coal
powered
power plants, coal fired power plants are really bad in most regions. But yeah, I mean, like you said, here we have hydropower. Transportation is 54% of our greenhouse gas emissions. So we have to, I mean, if we're going to contribute at all to, yeah, you know, reducing or slowing or, you know, or stopping catastrophic climate change, we have to get out of our cars.
And if that lofty, high-minded goal doesn't win for you, if you have a transit system, you get home faster. If you're in the car or if you're on the train, you get home. You're a little healthier if you've walked actually to the train station. I mean, in almost every measure, you're better off with a mass transit system than you are without one in a city. Like, it makes everyone happier, people who use it and don't use it, but it is costly to build. And that's sort of the fun thing. I don't know why we vote on this. This is like, you know, if you think about the continue our game theory measure here, like, this is, it makes sense maybe to vote on things where, like, services that you're going to get the benefit from that next year. But to ask people to vote on something that's going to benefit people for 50 years in the future, it's nuts. It's like an inverse lottery. You're like voting to get like a bad lottery ticket.
But it's not nuts. I mean, it may be nuts from like a game theory perspective, but it's not nuts from the political perspective, because people vote for it who aren't going to be using it and who aren't going to be affected by it. People, you know, on the west side of the city voted for light rail, and it's only being served by the, you know, the southeast part of the city. And I think that's really interesting.
That's true. I mean, but I kind of wish just, you know, elected representatives just sit down and do it.
Here's a great big new tax, voters. Have fun paying.
Yeah, yeah.
I think people resent things like this less when they're like at least given the option. And in Seattle, we always say yes.
We do always say yes, except with the monorail. After five asks, though. So, you know, I'm only a little bit bitter about this. So I'm going to tell you. I'm going to admit now that I ended up voting yes on this package. When I sat down with it, I agonized over this. I voted on Washington's mail-in voting, so you could vote over a week's period. I waited till, like, the last minute. I was, like, took mine to the poll at 8 o'clock at night and dropped it off. And I had just the worst time. And ended up deciding that things like, once you build the roads, things like congestion pricing and mandatory HOV lanes and things like that can mitigate some of what the lane usage is. But it's a whole other nasty argument that I don't even know if I can win on that one.
Well, having looked at the package pretty closely, I voted against it. And, you know, there's no congestion pricing mandated in it. Mm-hmm. And I want to see mandates before I'm going to vote for roads. And in fact, I mean, a lot of, you know, 150 of the lane miles were general purpose with no kind of congestion. There are 30 miles that were HOV or hot lanes, which mm-hmm. where you would have a toll, but there's no guarantee at all. And, you know, and at the same time, there are accountability measures that said all these roads are going to get built. We will build your roads that you voted for.
Even if we have to have extra taxes to pay for the cost.
Exactly, yeah.
So this is an interesting question, though. So now, you know, cities like Seattle that are pro-transit, sort of, are very much in favor of dealing with global warming. How do you think we could best use our political might to deal with it? We, you know, kind of agree on, like, the science says, like, these things. We need to reduce emissions by a dramatic amount to actually try to do something about global warming. Where's the best place that the political power, and we can talk about the ineptitude or relative so of the Seattle political delegation and state government, but what things do you think are politically feasible to actually push through?
I think we could get a cap and trade system through pretty easily here if there was a little more political pushing, particularly by people in Seattle. I mean, we have a mayor who is, you know, commendably, he's organized the mayor's climate conference and gotten, I think, something like 700 mayors to sign on to agree to meet Kyoto by 2012. That's a nice gesture. And I think it actually symbolically is really great because, you know, all these mayors are talking about, you know, this issue that was not on their radar screen 5 years ago. But, you know, it would be nice to have a mayor out there really stumping for more transit and stumping for, you know, for a fully auctioned cap and trade system. I think that is something that is politically feasible and would actually have a lot of impact.
So, and maybe one of us should describe exactly what a cap and trade system is.
Oh, I'll let you do that. It's really hard to explain.
You basically set a limit of how much total carbon can be emitted, and then you sell them. You essentially auction off pieces of that total amount. And that way, you both make some cost of what it to emit carbon into the atmosphere, as well as sort of make sure that you're hit some absolute maximum. Now, how to enforce compliance and all these things is an interesting question. I'm not a big fan of carbon trading without a cap.
Right. I think you absolutely have to have a cap.
You absolutely have to have a cap, and then it gets in question how to enforce it. I agree, though. I mean, it seems like the most tractable solutions. The other way, maybe, is just tax carbon sources, like bump up the gas tax and coal tax and, you know, everything that goes into it. But then I'm going to push back on you a little bit, because in the region, if we broaden the region out a little bit, one of the major industries of the region is building airplanes, which are a huge emitter of carbon gases into the atmosphere. So even if, you know, the Boeing plant in Everett is fantastically efficient and is, you know, very limited in its carbon emissions, the product that's being built is somewhat devastating. And then there's interesting, really interesting papers. There's a paper that for a study that was done right after September 11th, when there was a total grounding of aircraft in the domestic, in the continental United States, that showed that places around major airports actually had a reduction in nighttime temperatures. So yeah. In other words, there's a local impact by air traffic on climate. And so this gets into a whole other point about, you know, in general, that's what we can export here, because people want to buy airplanes. It's one of the few things made in the United States beyond garbage that other countries are willing to buy. And so, And, you know, and that, how do you jibe with that sort of? I mean, this is where, again, I start to feel despairing and say we should just build really big water reservoirs up in the mountains.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't think, I don't know how much the Boeing plant contributes to our economy at this anymore. I mean, I assume it's a pretty significant amount. I don't know the exact amount. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I think that in a cap and trade system, I mean, you're creating a market-based system within mm-hmm. the whole region where, like, you know, I mean, if we were a big coal economy, I mean, we would have the same thing. Every state that institutes this kind of system is going to have a back and forth. I mean, we're all part of the problem. So I guess, you know, I'm not as despairing as you about that. I mean, I think that, I don't think it's going to destroy our economy.
Oh, I don't think it'll destroy the economy either per se. But I think it gets into a question about how one actually gets where you need to go. So, well. Well, I'm going to stay despaired, you stay optimistic, and we'll appreciate all of you, dear listeners, for continuing to listen. Thank you again for listening to another Dear Science podcast. You can read my column every other week at www.thestranger.com. Thank you, Erica, very much.
Thanks.